Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, some of the effects of President Trump's orders imposing sweeping new tariffs.
Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum.
We'll talk about the tariffs and more of the week's news with our Week in Review panelists. Also today, the mystery of Amelia Earhart.
Although women as yet have not taken full advantage of its use and benefits, air travel is as available to them as to men.
Researchers say Earhart's disappearance may have been unwittingly solved decades ago. Plus, why over the past few decades there's been little progress improving diversity on screen. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. President Trump this week continued his pattern of making some bold proposals and then drawing them back a bit. The issue this time, tariffs on steel and aluminum. The president signed the orders for the tariffs yesterday, saying that he was going to save the U.S. steel industry from other countries, especially China, that flood the American market with cheap products.
It's a process called dumping. And they dumped more than at any time on any nation, anywhere in the world. And it drove our plants out of business. It drove our factories out of business. And we want a lot of steel coming into our country, but we want it to be fair.
But Sam Blatchford from the New England-based American Steel and Aluminum Company says that just the talk of tariffs sent his prices higher.
We've seen a dramatic increase in prices between anywhere from, 25 to 40%, depending on the product category. It's more about availability, making sure that we do have an ample supply, and it's difficult to get the material into New England to begin with.
And Rick Maher of Woburn's Lord Hobo Brewing Company says those increases in prices could harm his company's growth.
This would hit us deep into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Any artificial increase to input costs to our business is pretty painful. So increasing those input costs by 10 or 25% is a drag and, money that otherwise could be invested in our growth.
So will these new tariffs help protect American businesses or increase costs all the way around? That's just one of the topics we're going to take up with our Week in Review panel today. With us in studio, Jennifer Braceras, conservative political analyst and a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, also former editor-in-chief of NewBostonPost.com. Jennifer, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us, Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thanks for coming in as well, Michael.
Good to be here.
Okay, so let's start with the president and tariffs, and started out saying blanket tariffs, but then there was all kinds of chaos in Washington over what this proposal might mean. So when he did sign the order yesterday about the tariffs, the president did exempt Canada and Mexico from the tariffs in the hopes of renegotiating NAFTA more favorably for the U.S. What's your reaction, A, to the tariffs, Michael, and B, to this strategy?
The reaction to the tariffs, I think it's kind of a classic, in some ways, classic Trump move in two ways. One is that it is actually one of the few things that he's had a consistent view on for decades and that he's actually sort of following through on. People are kind of shocked about that because he's been generally pretty erratic in his views. On the other hand, it's also kind of classic Trump in that he's kind of approached it with a kind of ready, fire, aim, trajectory in which they seem to be kind of making things up as they're going along. Even at the ceremony yesterday, there was talk online that it wasn't clear if they actually had a formal agreement he was signing or was this a placeholder while they were still working out the details. So it was kind of classic kind of Trump White House chaos that seemed to be unfolding. Mm-hmm. And I think, as for the tariffs themselves, I think I kind of side with the 90% of economists who don't see this as a particularly wise move. It's not going to, overnight revive the steel an aluminum industry here, I don't think it's going to be disastrous either. I mean, I think the bigger issue or concern is sort of the signal it may send about what could be coming down the road in terms of, you know, is this the approach this administration is going to take to what is really an increasingly globalized economy? Mm-hmm. That's, I think, where the shockwaves are kind of coming. If it's steel and aluminum today, I mean, are we going to sort of set up a way to sort of revive our textile and garment industry in the U.S. or, you know, you just don't really know what's next.
Right. And what does it mean about Gary Cohn and all that? We'll get to that in a second. But I'm also wondering, Jennifer, what do you think about this and about the fact that key Republicans were opposed to this?
Well, conservatives have long been in favor of free trade. And this is a position that doesn't comport with most conservative ideology. Most Republicans are against it. In fact, the people who favor it most are Rust Belt Democrats. But as Michael said, this is one of a few positions that President Trump has been consistent on. He campaigned on it. He campaigned hard on it, and he arguably won the election because of it in those key Rust Belt swing states.
Right. And we did hear, the big concern really is international reaction to this, how other countries are going to react. And we heard from the European Union. European Union officials said that they would raise import duties on a number of U.S. products, including bourbon, peanut butter, motorcycles. So some folks are saying, okay, bourbon.
Not bourbon.
Kentucky.
No.
Mitch McConnell.
Right.
Harley Davidson, motorcycle, Wisconsin, Paul Ryan. But, you know, is this political on the part of international folks saying we're going to target?
Of course it is. When, okay. Yeah, because when George Bush actually did this during his presidency, George W. Bush, and ended up repealing them after folks in the European Union said that they were going to specifically target Florida and other swing states for his upcoming election. They were going to target products that went into those states so that the quality of life for those people might take a turn for the worse and he would lose those votes. I mean, that was, you know, people play politics on both sides of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just was wondering if that was someone's conspiracy theory or if you actually thought that it was legitimate here.
I think it's absolutely legitimate. I mean, those things happen.
So let's talk about Gary Cohn, as we mentioned, that we were going to talk about, the president's former now chief economic advisor. He stepped aside this week. Many said it was because he doesn't agree with this whole tariff notion. And he was really the free trade person in the president's cabinet. And the president said this about Cohn this week.
He's been terrific. He may be a globalist, but I still like him. He is seriously a globalist, no question. But you know what? In his own way, he's a nationalist because he loves our country.
Now, there's all kinds of debate about what that use of the term globalist might mean. Is it a dog whistle to the alt-right here or a pejorative comment? What do you make of the president describing Gary Cohn as a globalist here? Michael?
I guess I would sort of give him the benefit of the doubt and just call it, you know, take it at face value that, you know, he's clearly part of the wing of the administration that has not embraced the Trump views on protectionism. And he was the free trader. And there were, frankly, a lot of them in there. I mean, you know, the irony of Trump railing against Wall Street is that he brought in all these, you know, Wall Street guys and Goldman Sachs people. And Cohn was certainly part of that. So, you know, I mean, the funnier thing is that, you know, when he talks about, you know, I like him and he likes me. I mean, with Trump, everything is a matter of, you know, who's liked and who's liking whom. And he's a globalist, but I like him. It gets divorced from the policy. But it does signal, again, the sort of continuing exit of those folks from the White House, which is troubling, I think, to mainstream Republicans and potentially to the markets
point. And that was what you had mentioned that you think is really the bigger issue here. Bigger than the tariffs is the fact that what's gone on around this and what that might mean for future economic policy. So what do you mean by that?
I mean, I just think that this is really the first major move by the president to make good on that protectionist view that he propounded on the campaign trail. And so if it signals sort of a turn and that this is the first of what are going to be many steps, then I think that is potentially much more troubling, to the country, to Republican base, than if it's just sort of a one-off. And again, you know, if he turns next week and it's, you know, he could swing in the other direction or go with something else. So I think that's the thing that we don't really know, whether he's actually going to say, you know, this is the thing I campaigned on, as Jennifer said, I'm going to really make good on it. And this is, you know, step one and there's five more coming.
Hmm. I think it has some interesting implications for international relations and international law generally, because The WTO doesn't have to approve this. And then, of course, if they don't approve it, Donald Trump and this administration can say, who cares, right? And so up until this point, the World Trade Organization has operated successfully because the participants abide by their rulings. They choose to abide by their rulings. But if this president decides, I don't have to abide by their rulings, and he doesn't legally, then there's no reason for any other country to abide by their rulings. And the whole sort of international order collapses as a house of cards. So it has much broader implications than just steel.
Right. Right. And do you think that these will have these tariffs will have a damaging effect on the economy?
My sense is they will. I'm not an economist, but I agree, like Michael said, with the majority of economists who think that it will. It may be a small effect. I think politically, Donald Trump wins at home with this because even just showing that he's trying to do something engenders so much loyalty to him from people in those key Rust Belt states. And if the impact is small, whether it's, you know, small in a positive way or small in a negative way, they still feel like he's fighting for them, mm-hmm. which was, you know, that was his calling card, and that's why they love him.
Right. Well, let's talk about some things that are a little bit closer to home, the recent nor'easters, and now the talk of global climate change because of them. Now, as of airtime, there were still some 160,000 Massachusetts customers without power, mostly in the Merrimack Valley. We had two storms with strong winds, heavy rains. We saw astronomical high tides in the past week. And twice this winter, Massachusetts has been hit by a so-called 100-year storm. And I do want to say, weather is not climate, but the frequency and the severity of these storms have many people wondering if we are ready for the effects of climate change in Massachusetts. Governor Charlie Baker over the weekend surveyed coastal damage, and this is what he said.
A lot of the coastal stuff is probably going to be part of our future, and we need to come up with some plans for that.
And on Wednesday, during the storm, WBUR spoke with Karen Keneally in Scituate, and she said she's worried about long-term effects.
You know, they keep saying, oh, this is a once-in-a-100-year storm, and we've had how many of them in the past 12 months? So I feel that sometime it's going to be time to reevaluate. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, are officials doing enough to prepare here, and can they? Michael, your thoughts.
I mean, I think there is a fair amount that has been going on, both in the city, or particularly in the city of Boston. I don't think that we're nearly ready if it's going to be, things are going to be coming at the pace of these two storms. So I think, it's kind of a yes and no answer. It's certainly on their radar and there are steps being taken. Some things, though, feel a little, we're talking about building codes or in the seaport, places where they're putting infrastructure on upper floors. It's a little bit of admitting defeat when they're sort of assuming that there is going to be a good chance of water flooding into those areas. It's still better than nothing.
Well, I think you have to assume that. I mean, when you build essentially on the water, eventually the ocean is going to come back and attempt to reclaim what was taken from it, whether that's in the Back Bay or at the seaport. And I think the question is, you have to have a strategy for developing those areas to begin with. How much is too much is not the wrong question. But if you're going to develop there, the questions that people have to ask are, how can we be prepared? And I think from a political standpoint and even a marketing standpoint, people have spent inordinate amounts of energy on going green and trying to prevent climate change, when in fact, the real emphasis should be on being prepared for it and climate resiliency. It's sort of like a person who's aging and they're desperately trying to stop the aging process with all sorts of plastic surgery instead of figuring out how can they live their life under this new set of circumstances, which in some sense is inevitable. I mean, we can do things to limit the effects of climate change, but we're not going to turn back the clock.
Hmm. We did a show about this earlier this week, as we said, and we heard from a caller who said he was Joe in Dorchester, and he said he was frustrated with dealing with extreme weather that seems to keep coming and feeling as if officials aren't doing enough. Let's listen to what he said.
The seaport is going to be underwater in 25 years, and they won't stop building there, and it floods all the time. I'm in Dorchester right now in gridlock traffic on Dorchester Ave because Morrissey Boulevard is flooding. So what is the government of this state doing about it? Because I've had it.
And, of course, we did talk with someone in government, Boston's Chief of Environment, Energy and Open Space, Austin Blackman. He spoke with us during the show, and he said that there are concrete things that the city's already accomplished.
We've come up with shovel-ready projects, and we've actually announced that we're going to be moving forward with implementation on $2 million worth of them as well, both to protect an area of Charlestown close to the Sullivan Square, and then also in East Boston on the East Boston Greenway, which is one of the very first flood entry pathways that allows water not only to go through the Greenway, but then actually shuttle past several other neighborhoods of East Boston as well.
Now, Michael, Jennifer brought up an interesting question. How much is too much or how much is enough, right? Isn't that the question here? So do you think that the city has made significant strides toward trying to prepare the state? Governor Baker says he plans to file legislation as early as next week. What more could be done, do you think?
I think they're making strides. I don't think they've done enough. I mean, we clearly have seen that we're not really prepared for these kind of events if they're going to happen with this kind of regularity. But I think that we may need to start thinking a little more outside the box. I mean, just for one example, we had a piece submitted at Commonwealth Magazine by three architects 2 months ago that we ran on our website in which they proposed a 14-mile dike that would run out in Boston Harbor all the way from Swampscott down to Cohasset. And to be honest, we kind of hesitated before we posted it, wondering if this was, frankly, a bit of a crackpot idea. The price tag, I'll tell you, is in the billions, and it's, you know, somewhere between, I think, $30 and $50 billion. But I'm seeing more talk about things like that are ways that, you know, you're not going to prevent the change. But there's some logic to this idea of trying to mitigate the rush of the tides. And they pointed to sort of some natural benefits we have of these highlands, both at on the North Shore and the South Shore, that would be kind of the bookends for that. So again, 2 months ago, I hadn't really read about it. I thought it seemed a little out there. I'm not so sure now that they might not be onto something.
Right.
And it may take something bigger than that. I'm not sure that, you know, what we're going to hear from the governor or some of the steps the city is taking are, you know, probably looks sort of more like small ball compared to what might need to happen.
Right. Do you think, Jennifer, that we'll see something big from the governor after this suggestion that he's going to do something next week, but we're not exactly sure what, possibly another study, but we don't know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. What I've heard him say before is that we need a coast-to-coast study and that the solutions for one community might not be the same as the solutions for another community, which I think are right. And this is a problem that, you know, the developers are going to have to tackle, the engineers are going to have to tackle. But government's going to have to tackle it as well, both with studies and possibly new regulations on the way in which we develop. You know, as a conservative, I'm not generally for a lot of regulation, but this is an area where I think it's really necessary because it's the one thing that all people really want from their government is to keep them safe, whether from terrorism or natural disaster. And so in an area like this, I think it's incumbent upon government to regulate for the greater good. So, you know, I think it's going to have to be a multifaceted approach. Families and individual communities are going to have to look at the structures that they live in and figure out how to shore them up as well and how to tend to the vulnerable within their communities in the case of natural disasters. There have to be community plans and family plans in place.
Okay, I want to just make sure we can talk about politics before I let you go here. This week, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick was on KCUR radio in Kansas City, and he was asked if he was thinking about a presidential run.
It's on my radar screen, but, you know, it's a huge decision. It's a huge consideration, I think, particularly when I think, you know, I'm still a kid from the south side of Chicago, and I am trying to think through 2020, and that's a decision I'm trying to think through from a personal and family point of view, and also whether, you know, what I believe is going to be on offer by somebody.
So, Michael Jonas, when you hear that response from former Governor Patrick, what do you think? Is he going to run?
Put me down as a little bit of a skeptic. I'm just not convinced that that's really what's in his future. I mean, I think most people around here remember the grave reservations that his wife had about him entering into public life. And I'm also just, I'm not sure that, I don't know, that he's going to be sort of what the doctor ordered when the race comes along. I mean, his His message here was, you know, very sort of aspirational and thematic is what he offered voters. You know, now perhaps if people are looking for somebody, you know, after this sort of divisive time that sort of gives that message of unity and bringing people together, that maybe that'll have some appeal. But I'm not yet convinced that it's going to be a Patrick moment.
Hmm. Jennifer, what do you think? Should he run?
Well, I don't know. I mean, not if the Democrats want to win. I think it's interesting because they clearly didn't get the memo. You know, they clearly didn't get the feeling of the country in November, you know, 2016, right? And so instead, they keep talking about all these candidates who are just more of the same. And the presidential election of 2016 was a referendum on Barack Obama as well as the Clinton era. And I think that if they want to run a candidate who can appeal to people in the Rust Belt and to the typical Trump voter, they're going to have to find somebody along the lines of, say, Seth Moulton, someone who's had military service, somebody who can relate to the average worker, unionized worker in Pennsylvania or Ohio or Wisconsin. Donald Trump was able to do that. Hillary Clinton was not. I don't know that Deval Patrick, you know, with his Ivy League pedigree, is going to be able to do that, maybe.
Hmm. Okay. Also, in terms of politics here, it's also legal as well. The charges of extortion against two aides in Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's administration. There were federal prosecutors this week said in a court filing that they may have to dismiss the case against Marty Walsh's aides. The prosecutors said if the judge in the case doesn't reconsider his proposed jury instructions, then the case would be on a collision course with dismissal here. Now, these are two aides who worked for Marty Walsh who are charged with trying to pressure the organizers of the 2014 Boston Calling Festival into hiring union labor. So what do you make here of these statements that, A, the case may be dismissed, and if it is, what does this mean politically for Marty Walsh? I'd like both of you to just answer that briefly because we're running out of time. Michael?
Well, I mean, it'd certainly be good for Marty Walsh to have this thing cleared off the table, I guess. I mean, the legal question, I think this possible outcome has been kind of brewing. We've seen it in a number of other cases where to sum it up succinctly, what might be to everyone's agreement unseemly is not necessarily unlawful. And I think that's what this case, just like the probation case we saw in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. the sort of federal case involving the former governor of Virginia that sort of set a sort of precedent for these things is showing that these are political issues that need to be hashed out there. If you have objection to what's going on, they may not really be, legal issues.
So I think without getting too much into the legal thicket, I think that essentially what's going on is that the law within the First Circuit isn't clear. And the government feels that they're on very strong legal footing because all of the other circuits that have decided this issue have decided that the alleged extorters don't have to have personally benefited from the extortion. Mm-hmm. The judge in this case, Judge Sorokin, essentially said that his jury instruction would instruct otherwise. Now, Judge Sorokin is an excellent judge, but I think what the prosecution is saying, not that they don't have confidence in their own case, just that they think he's wrong as a matter of law. And I think the reason Sorokin teed it up this early in the case was because I think they're all looking for guidance from the First Circuit. So they're essentially preparing it for an interlocutory appeal so that the First Circuit can weigh in and provide the legal clarity.
Mm-hmm. You can tell who's the lawyer here and who isn't, right?
How about politically for Marty Walsh? I mean, obviously it's good if it gets dismissed, but has it stained him quite considerably?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's pretty popular. So
right.
I think, as Michael said, he probably wants it to go away.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have, just about a minute here. So let's end with our hubbubs, and those are the brief stories or news events that may have caught our attention this week but may not be the headline. Jennifer, do you have a hubbub?
Well, my hubbub is out of Providence, Rhode Island, where they instituted cameras to track speeding motorists.
Mm.
And I guess they came up with 12,000 people who were violating the speeding laws. And they all got tickets for about $100, and many of them showed up to fight their tickets and complain, and the courts were overloaded.
Yeah.
But I thought it was funny because this is probably the way things are going now with technology. And also with complaints that you know, police sort of selectively stop motorists on the basis of race or other things. This is a good neutral way to get everybody. But when
any of those 12,000 are listening, they might not think so.
No, they might not think so. But I wonder how politicians will deal with this.
And Michael?
Mine's a little bit on a more somber note is a hubbub or a shout out really to the students at high schools in Cambridge, Somerville, a few other communities that walked out this week. Sort of to call attention for and call for changes in gun laws. And there's going to be sort of a setup for the national walkout that's going to happen next week, which will be the one-month anniversary of the shootings in Parkland. And I think one thing is that people said after the Sandy Hook shootings that if the slaughtering of six-year-olds doesn't get anyone to change, then nothing will. And in a weird way, I think what's happened is now, sadly, the victims have changed age. They're high school students, and they're old enough to sort of give voice to this themselves and take action, but maybe you could say they're young enough and idealistic enough to think they might actually be able to make something happen. So that's sort of where that's at.
All right. Can I give a really bad pun here? Because my hubbub is about something that doesn't pass the smell test. Can I say that? Okay. So Governor Baker says he's looking into why State Transportation Department's office officials in Boston spent $100,000 on a new bathroom. A private bathroom for the board member, apparently, right next to the public bathroom. And a DOT spokesperson said that they needed this private bathroom because sometimes during public meetings, reporters follow board members into the public bathroom, so they needed one of their own. So I just want to point that out to folks. $100,000 for the bathroom. Okay, Michael Jonas, Executive Director of Commonwealth Magazine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Jennifer Braceras, Conservative Political Analyst, Senior Fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and former editor in chief of NewBostonPost.com. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. More than 3 weeks after the deadly school shooting in Parkland, Florida, some students are demanding that Congress pass tougher gun control laws. At the same time, gun control advocates are urging states to take up the fight, and they point to Connecticut as a model. After the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School more than 5 years ago, Connecticut passed some of the toughest gun laws in the country, and advocates say they're working. WBUR's Anthony Brooks has this report.
Thank you for being here. Thank you. We appreciate it.
School safety and the shootings in Parkland, Florida were the focus of a recent discussion at the Silver Lane Elementary School in East Hartford, Connecticut. The small group included Governor Daniel Malloy, teachers, and parents like Nicole Nathaniel.
A lot of kids are worrying. It kind of throws off their focus in the classroom. They should be focusing on their schoolwork, but they're wondering who's going to come through the building.
As a parent, Nicole Nathaniel understands that worry. Back in 2012, about an hour south of here, Adam Lanza shot his way into the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, killing 20 first graders and 6 educators. Since then, there have been more than 200 school shootings across the country, including the one in Parkland, Florida, last month.
I think we've really reached a tipping point. I think Parkland struck a chord or a nerve.
This is Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Connecticut Democrat, who joined the discussion in East Hartford.
And the students who are in the streets and state capitals are demanding that we do better. The time for action based on the Connecticut model is now.
The Connecticut model is a series of gun measures that are among the toughest in the country, signed into law following Sandy Hook, after people like Poe Murray of Newtown demanded action.
I did not lose a child, but the shooter was my neighbor, and I have 4 children that attended the Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Murray heads the Newtown Action Alliance, which advocates for stricter gun laws. After the Sandy Hook shooting, advocates like her wanted Congress to take action, just like the students from Parkland, Florida are demanding now. But in the wake of the nation's worst school shooting, Washington did nothing.
We were completely heartbroken and distraught and very angry that they did not honor with action after the tragedy here. More importantly, though, what we did was we watched other mass shootings occurring over and over and again.
But where Congress failed to act, Connecticut did. State lawmakers expanded an assault weapons ban and outlawed high-capacity magazines. They required background checks for the sale of all firearms, tightened gun ownership regulations, and increased funding for mental health and school security. Governor Daniel Malloy pushed hard for the measures, signed them into law, and says they're working.
Crime is down here. Homicides are down here. Violent crime is down here more than it is anywhere else in the country in the last 4 years.
Malloy says Florida lawmakers should have passed similar laws after the 2016 attack on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, when a gunman slaughtered 49 people.
If Florida had done, after the Orlando shooting, what Connecticut had done, the Parkland shooting couldn't have taken place.
There's no way to know that for sure. But it is true that the Florida killer bought his AR-15-style rifle, which is banned in Connecticut, legally from a Florida gun shop. According to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, states with the strictest gun laws, like Connecticut, California, and Massachusetts, have the lowest rates of gun deaths. While states with the least restrictive laws, like Alaska, Alabama, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, have the highest. Governor Malloy says the lesson from Connecticut is that fewer guns lead to less violence. Another is that it's possible to oppose the NRA and win.
NRA is very powerful, and I think it was a big thing in allowing the legislature to realize that they could stand up to the pressure of the NRA. They could pass meaningful legislative changes, and we got it done.
I think what Connecticut did was go about it from the wrong approach.
Scott Wilson is among those who say Connecticut went too far and is trampling on Second Amendment rights. Wilson heads the Connecticut Citizens Defense League, which challenged the state's gun laws in federal court and lost. But he says a better way to make schools safer is to make them more secure and give teachers the means to defend themselves.
We do know that the killer in Sandy Hook shot his way into the school. And the first person that encountered Adam Lanza was the principal of the school, and she was, you know, summarily executed on the spot. And it would have been helpful if this person, Adam Lanza, had been met with proportionate response to put an end to his threat to the children in that school.
Wilson argues we protect banks and state capitals with guns. Why not schools?
I think that would be a fair solution as opposed to stripping and eradicating our constitutional rights little by little.
Back at the Silver Lane Elementary School in East Hartford, Governor Malloy says he wants to spend more on making schools safer, but he opposes arming teachers. Everybody here agrees with that, including the teachers, the parents, and Senator Richard Blumenthal.
The Connecticut model of school safety is a national model for how we can make schools safer without weaponizing our educators.
Since Sandy Hook, more than two dozen states have passed or introduced laws to loosen some of their gun laws, not strengthen them. It remains to be seen if the shootings in Parkland, Florida, will reverse that trend.
That report from WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. The mystery of the disappearance of the first woman to fly alone across the Atlantic Ocean may be solved. A new study says bones that were found on a Pacific island in 1940 may have been misidentified and may actually have been the bones of Amelia Earhart. For more, we're joined now by Deborah Michaels, director of the Women's and Gender Study at Merrimack University in North Andover. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how are you?
So tell us what this new study found.
Well, the new study basically was a look at the original study using some new forensic technology, and it was designed to see whether or not the original results were correct. And the original results basically said that the bones found on that island were the bones of a stocky male, not a female.
Mm-hmm. And so now this study, which actually didn't look at the bones, though, looked at the records from the 1940 analysis of the bones, compared some new photos and said, nope, not a stocky male.
Exactly. The professor who has been studying this, he's the same professor, Richard Jantz, who found that photograph a year ago, I think it was, that said that she could have survived and been taken captive by the Japanese. So I think he's been looking at whatever happened to Amelia Earhart for some time. And he first said in 1998 that the original findings of the 1940 study of the bones was wrong. But the forensics weren't there yet in 1998. And in 2015, there was another study that said, no, 1940 got it right. It's really a male. And only now, using this other new technology, has he been able to say, I don't think so. I think it's a woman. Actually, they got it wrong.
But do you think a lot of folks might be skeptical because you're saying it's new forensic technology, but you're essentially analyzing medical records that are 76 years old and not the actual bones themselves?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'm not a forensic psychologist or a psychiatrist, or I don't do this kind of work at all. So I can't speak to whether or not forensic science is in a far enough place that we should trust this result. But what I can say is that the mystique around the disappearance of Amelia Earhart will lead a lot of people to that conclusion, that without the real bones, how do we know?
Right, right. So do you think that this will close the book on the mystery, or you think we're still going to be hearing about it for quite some time?
I think that Jantz thinks it's going to close the book on Amelia Earhart, and I think there are a lot of people who might agree. What's interesting about the findings and his new findings, I think it has a lot to do with gender, because I think the original forensic scientist expected to find the bones of what would have been the average sized woman in the 1940s, which was about 5'3". And Amelia Earhart was 5'9". Mm-hmm. So I think he made the conclusions he made based on the fact that the bones didn't fit a gender pattern. But no, I don't think this is going to close the book on it. I think people, without the bones, it still leaves open this tiny little wedge for people who want to believe that we still never know whatever happened to her.
All right. Deborah Michaels, Director of Women's and Gender Studies at Merrimack University in North Andover. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the film adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time. And is this a landmark moment for on-screen diversity? I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
We heard a cry out in the universe.
My father's alive.
We believe he is, and we're here to help you find him.
The film adaptation of Madeleine L'Engle's book, A Wrinkle in Time, is out today. The latest major Hollywood movie getting accolades for diversity. Our next guests say this on-screen diversity is progress, but their study of children's animated TV found that there really hasn't been all that much progress. Joining me in studio is Julie Dobrow, senior lecturer at the Department of Child Study and Human Development at Tufts University. Hello.
Good morning.
Also with us is Calvin Chip Gidney, an associate professor, also at the Department of Child Study and Human Development at Tufts. Hi.
Hi.
So you are co-authors, along with Tufts professor Jennifer Burton, on a piece published in The Conversation that's titled, Why It's So Important for Kids to See Diverse TV and Movie Characters. So Chip, I'm wondering if you could say what you think of this moment with films like Wrinkle in Time, Black Panther. This is a big moment, right?
Right. We've been doing our study for over 4 years, and yet because of the particular moment we're in with Black Panther, with A Wrinkle in Time, and also with the discussion about Oscars So White, if we can go back to that. Right. It's a moment where people are really interested in issues of representation.
Right, right. And so do you think that it's really something different here, or is this sort of just the issue of the day? You know how those happen, right? There might be an issue and then it'll fade. Or do you think we're really at a significant moment?
I think we're at a significant moment, partly because of larger demographic trends within the United States. Mm-hmm. I think our population is changing. The proportion of people of color is also changing. And I think people have a newfound idea to demand that they be represented in the media that they consume. Mm.
Julie, your study here, it specifically looks at, what, as we said, animated children's TV. And you wrote that the animated worlds that children see on TV are out of sync with their real environments. What did you find in your study?
Well, it's interesting, Deb, because we've looked at this for a number of years, as Chip suggested. And while we have found that things are getting better, they're not getting as better as we would like them to be. So when our previous researchers have looked at issues of diversity, they found, for instance, that in the world of children's animated programming, that there are huge inequities in race and ethnicity and in gender. So some of the earliest studies, for instance, found that there was a 6-to-1 ratio of male to female characters. In the studies that we've done, we found that it's gotten better. Now it's only 3-to-1.
But still 3-to-1.
Still 3-to-1.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know about how young people, children, are affected by this? Chip?
Well, I mean, children learn from their environments, and they learn from as much as from what they observe and actually see, but they also learn from more covertly from what they don't see represented on television. Mm-hmm. So sometimes if children don't see images of themselves doing things, if you're a girl and you don't see images of girls in leadership positions, you might assume, well, that's not something that girls do. So I think that children are very astute sociologists, if you will, or anthropologists. They're studying the media, and they're analyzing and making their judgments about how the world works from what they see portrayed in media.
Julie, why animated TV? Some folks' initial reaction might be, well, it's, you know, bopping someone over the head. It's naturally sort of violent and silly. How seriously can this be taken? Why this?
We think that it's important to go to where children are going, so that what we know from all of the research that's out there is that while children have very many different platforms that they can go on to, they are still going to television more than anything else. So we know that kids are consuming enormous amounts of television, even though the ways that they're consuming it may be a little bit different. So we thought that it was really important to try to look at the television that most children are watching. And for young children, that's animated television.
Hmm. I want to talk about stereotypes as well, because I think that that could be an issue. You know, it's, we hear about villains, and we do have a clip of tape here from Dr. Heinz Doofenshmirtz. And this is from the Disney Channel program Phineas and Ferb. And he speaks with a caricature of a German accent. Let's listen.
Penny the Platypus! Don't be shy. It's just me. Come here. You like my new cage? I got it from a secondhand shark supply store. It was half off because, you know, something bit half of it off.
So I'm wondering, Chip, what do you think? I mean, why is it that we have these sort of, you know, stereotyped accents here for our villains?
Well, it's because, you know, language is a really important indicator of our different multiple identities. I mean, I want you to just think, Deb, about what you can tell about a person just based on the way that that person speaks. Mm-hmm. You might be able to tell what region of the country or the world they're from, what socioeconomic status they belong to, their ethnic background, all these things, their gender, all these things are encoded in language.
Right.
So language becomes a really easy and quick way to tell a story and to put forth a narrative about a character without, you know, they only have 22 minutes in a cartoon. So right. They just put that, they use language as a shorthand.
And these stereotypes, the same kind of detrimental effect, you think, as what we're talking about in terms of diversity being represented in these productions?
Well, we've designed a three-part study to try to look at this. And so the first part has been what we call content analysis, where we're trying to figure out what's there. The second part of it is to try to understand why these stereotypes persist. And for that, we've started to interview some of the people who are the content creators.
Good idea.
So we're talking to the people who are writing and producing and directing and doing the vocal casting, and some of the actors, in fact, who are voicing characters. And we've started to ask them, why do these stereotypes persist in 2018? It's been really interesting to hear what some of the responses have been. And as Chip is suggesting, one of the things that we found so far, and I would have to say we're not at the end of this study, we're really just in the middle of it, but so far we've found that for a lot of the content creators, stereotypes are a kind of shortcut because they don't have a lot of time. And this is a way to build up character very quickly.
Hmm. And so if you were to improve diversity and sort of not make it so stereotypical, What are some of the things, or what are some of the examples where that isn't being done, or and that it's being done in a way that it doesn't just feel like a token, mm-hmm. right? So what do you say to that, Jeff?
I would say this. I'd say one way not to do it is just to have all the characters just speak standard American English, the dialect we're speaking right now. I mean, the reality...
Yeah, we're so boring.
the reality is that people speak all kinds of different ways in the world,
right.
And it doesn't mean that they're a good character or a good person or a bad person based on the way they speak. So I would say, let's have linguistic diversity mirror the linguistic diversity that we have in our lives. And have heroes and heroines who speak with a dialect, a non-standard dialect, and villains that speak standard English. There's nothing to say that we can't also diversify the language in children's shows.
I think another thing to improve diversity is to improve the diversity of the people who are creating media. And we're starting to see this. I think that's one of the reasons that this is a very exciting moment and why something like A Wrinkle in Time or Black Panther, it's part of the reason that they're doing so well at the box office, frankly. But it's also a great moment for those of us really care about issues of diversity in children's media, because the success of these sorts of things means that we're going to see more of it. Because nothing succeeds like success.
Right, right. And I just wonder, in terms of going back to the effects on young people, particularly children, does your research at this point suggest that there's any difference? So in terms of effects and race, is a white child affected differently than a child of color, boy affected differently than a girl? I mean, do you know if there's any difference at this point? Or
we're really just at the very beginning of that part of the study, but and I don't think we would feel comfortable making that sort of attribution at this point. But what we can tell you is that we've seen that children seem to know very quickly. They're really quick to divide characters into good and bad.
And so what does that suggest to you?
It suggests to us that they're talking about things that they've seen and that they've learned from other media. And based on our analysis of other media, they're going to be replicating stereotypes.
You know, I want to talk about also another way that we've heard of most recently about increasing diversity, Oscars. This mm-hmm. past weekend, of course, we heard actress Frances McDormand in her winning speech after she got Best Actress. She used her speech to congratulate the women in the room, and she also called for usage of so-called inclusion riders, which would ensure diversity in a film's cast and crew. This is a little clip of her speech. Let's listen.
We all have stories to tell and projects we need financed. Don't talk to us about it at the parties tonight. Invite us into your office in a couple days, or you can come to ours, whichever suits you best, and we'll tell you all about them. I have two words to leave with you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Inclusion rider.
So it was very, very forthcoming. This is the way that she says that there could be more diversity. Your thoughts on that, Chip?
I think that would be a wonderful idea, even in the world of children's television, because I think what's important is that there be a diversity of voices. Any one person, we all have a finite amount of experience of our own lives. But if you have diverse voices, you're going to guarantee a product that reflects the diversity of the people, the creative team that is creating it.
And do you think that that's the way to do it, to use this type of contract writer?
I think that's one very easy and simple legal way to make sure that you're getting a diversity of voices, and that, you know, I think it really decreases the likelihood that there will be stereotypes, because I think people from a variety of backgrounds would say, hey, no, I don't want that character voice that way.
Julie?
I'm not sure that we need to put it into any sort of writers. I think that if you have things that succeed in the box office, then that is going to mean that this is a model that works, and we're going to see more of it. It will encourage it throughout the industry.
So no, you don't have to put it in writing. You think, I mean, that's a big gamble when you're talking about, you know, multi-million-dollar movie to say if it succeeds, then other, you know what I mean?
So. Absolutely. But I think we're already seeing that with certainly with Black Panther. And I'd be willing to put money on Anna DuVernay and Wrinkle in Time as well.
Well, we'll see. It's out tonight, as we said. Just very, very briefly, most surprising thing you've come across so far, Julie?
I think I've really been surprised by two things. By how the stereotypes persist in the minds of the people who are creating them, the media, and also by how quick children are to make attributions.
And I guess I'd be surprised by the demographic disparities, how children's cartoons don't really yet look like the U.S. of A. in terms of demographics.
All right. Calvin Chip Gidney, an associate professor at Tufts, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Also with us was Julie Dobrow, senior lecturer at the Department of Child Study and Human Development at Tufts.
Thank you.
You can find a link to their piece at Why It's So Important for Kids to See Diverse TV and Movie Characters at our website, RadioBoston.org. That's our show for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.